Chapter 2. Crowl moved through one of the many snaking capillaries that twisted and interlocked within his home's old and deteriorating heart. Drifting suspensers cast weak light over the dark metal walls. Every panel he passed was inscribed with worn smooth homilies or excerpts from inquisitorial manuals. The air smelled both antiseptic and musty, as if the grime of ages were perpetually warring against endless efforts to erase it. Strange noises welled up intermittently from the levels below, muffled by distance and distorted by the citadel's many interior crannies. As he made his way higher, climbing up narrow spiral stairways, a servo skull swooped in close. It bobbed at his shoulder, its lone eye a dull, thoughtful orange.
"Where have you been, Gorgias?" Crowl asked.
"Amorias," the skull replied, "requiring replenio. Not enough?"
Crowl nodded, still climbing.
"It's being looked into. Revis is working all the hours he can."
The skull dipped and swerved around a floating suspensor caddy, making its lumen bulbs wobble.
"Furioso," he blurted.
"Yes, they will be."
Crowl paused.
"And what do you think of that, then? Who has the right to be angry at whom?"
Gorgias spun around on his vertical axis. For a moment, the skull seemed genuinely nonplussed. Then he darted off again, leading the way up the spiral.
"Periculo," he murmured aimlessly. "Periculoso."
Given its prestige and age, Corvain was not a particularly well-appointed citadel. It was by turns too cold and too hot, its air gritty from the overworked processes, its foundations slowly sinking into the silts below. But the upper apartments had at least a semblance of civility to them. Candles burned in deep alcoves, breaking the monotony of the sodium-yellow lumens. Fine statuary on devotional themes stood in recesses between the carved doorways. Much of the accumulation in such places was due to Crowl's forebears, but now and then there was a piece that he had collected himself, a jewelled copy of the Reflections of St. Adsel, or a chalice from one of the ruined chapels in the Renata Purge Zone. All such items were cared for rigorously, their plinths free of dust, their protective ward shields glistening faintly like spiders' webs. Spinoza was waiting for him in front of the doors to Crowl's council chamber. She, too, was out of armour, but somehow the reduction in bulk didn't seem to diminish her essential solidity. She stood unconsciously in a military stance, spine straight, shoulders back, as if she was still somehow serving alongside the Adeptus Astartes, rather than occupying a shadier role within the Ordo Hereticus. Spinoza might have made a fine space marine, Crowl thought, had she been a man. And if she had been a product of a different scholar, she might instead have ended up in the Adeptus Sororitas, something that he suspected she would have preferred if the choice had been presented to her. As it was, fate had dragged her into the bosom of the Inquisition, where she was now condemned to spend the rest of her mortal existence. There were so few real choices in the lives they all led, he reflected. Only different varieties of duty.
"My lord," she said,
bowing her head a fraction. Still, she persisted in that. Trying to get her to use names was, it seemed, a doomed endeavour.
"Khazad will live," Crowl informed her, signalling for the doors to open. "Just like you, Spinoza. Hard to put away."
The interrogator followed him inside. As they entered the chamber, a glow of lightning bled up from recessed panels, gilding the moribund space with a scatter of soft amber.
"I am glad of it," she said.
What did she make of the offer?
"She accepted," said Crowl, reaching for a goblet of wine.
Experience taught him that Spinoza wouldn't drink, so he poured just the one glass, adding the powdered narcotic mix from a dispenser at his wrist. It was a movement so practiced and familiar that he could have done it in his sleep.
"Which does her credit. We are hardly a choice employer at this time."
"Nonetheless, I believed she would."
Spinoza stood beside her usual place at the long council table, making no move to pull the chair out. That, too, was a minor irritant. Crowl had at times wondered just how long she'd stand there if he never invited her to sit. All night, probably. There had been times when he'd been tempted to test the hypothesis.
"Sit, please," he said,
lowering himself into the iron-inlaid throne at the head of the table. As he did so, a chime sounded from the other side of the room, where a second set of slide doors were half lost in shadow. Spinoza raised an eyebrow.
"I wanted Reavers here for this too," Kral said, unlocking them with a gesture. "This is about survival."
Gorgias adopted his favoured position, hovering between Kral and Spinoza. Reavers entered, acknowledged both of them, then took his place at the far end. The captain of the stormtroopers looked battered, as if caught out in bad weather for too long. There was a faint crackle as the chamber's sensor baffle field activated. Kral took a long sip of his wine, a trifle foxed by age, but not bad, then flexed his gloved fingers.
"One thing is certain. We cannot remain static," he said. "We must move again, despite what remains unknown."
Spinoza and Reavers listened. They had both been with him under the palace. No doubt they had also spent time contemplating what had to come next. The dust had settled in the old tombs. The great mass of pilgrims had reeled away from the final sanguinala rituals, drunk on religious fervour. But terror never rested. It was always a crucible, always in a churn of movement.
"So this is what we know," Kral went on. "A Xenos creature was brought to Terra. Its presence, it seems, was required for some purpose connected to the throne itself. Whatever the intention, the creature carved its own path under the palace and was ended there. It is possible that those behind its deliverance will let matters drop now. It is possible they will have learned their lesson and repented of consorting with such monsters."
He took another sip, then let slip a wry smile.
"But it is also possible that their folly knows no limit, and that having come this far, they will attempt to finish what they have started. We must understand what they wish for. We must understand who they are."
"You mentioned lords of the council," said Spinoza warily.
"Three of them," said Kral. "That is what Khazad's master Phaelius believed, and that is what the Xenos told me. No evidence, no names, just accusations from unreliable mouths."
Gorgias began to agitate.
"Traitoris," he blurted. "Castigatio."
"Yes, very possibly," said Kral.
"But," Spinoza began, then trailed off.
Kral looked at her tolerantly.
"Go on," he said.
"All of us were hunting it," she said. "All of us rejoiced that it is dead. Perhaps beyond that, the truth of these charges, perhaps that is less clear."
"I know you wish to think that," said Kral. "I understand why. But I spoke to Rassilo at the end. There is division within the council. The three, if it is three, have kept their tasks secret from the others, and a virtuous policy is not kept secret. They can't stop now. They will carry on, maybe attempt the same thing again, maybe try some other scheme, but they can't stop. And if our involvement in this becomes known, they will come for us too."
"Surely too late for that," said Reavers.
"Maybe not," said Kral.
"Consider this. Rassilo was killed. All those she took with her into the catacombs were killed or taken away by the custodians. They will not be coming back, at least not with the same minds they entered with. The same can be said for those led by the heretic Lermontov, whose life was ended here, by my own hand.
So, who is left to witness our presence? Who among those who commissioned this can truly know what happened in the vaults?
I do not know. It may be they have gleaned nothing at all and are left to guess what took place. Or it may be they know everything. We cannot presume one way or the other."
"The custodian, though?"
asked Reavers.
Kral sighed. "Ah, yes, Navradaran. I would very much like to speak to him again, but my attempts have failed. I should not be surprised. Either he chooses to remain silent, or he has been assigned to some other mission and cannot hear me. They are not servants to be held at one's beck and call."
He drank again. The narcotic blend was taking its time to work, and he felt pain throb in his glands.
"We are on our own, with limited information. Our first task must be to change that. We must uncover the complete picture. He leaned forward, placing his elbows on the table. Thalias believed that the speaker of the Chartist captains was involved. That would seem likely, given information I received from Navradaran. There was a contact in the speaker's service, a woman named Dlucha, who was in correspondence with those responsible for bringing the Xenos out of the deep void. Thalias discovered that she had been dead for 5 years before this started, and so the name itself is a cipher, but there was clearly some involvement there. Remember also that bringing such cargo to Terra undetected is hard. I find it difficult to imagine any such scheme being enacted without the speaker being somehow entangled.
That's one, then, said Rivas. Another two to find.
The second must be the Fabricator General, said Kral. The cargo was first landed at Skalax, and the final ship used in the transit was a Mechanicus vessel. Again, I cannot imagine that happening without his knowledge. Thalias was also of this view.
The third, then? Asked Spinoza.
There we reach the end of certainty, said Kral. If there was indeed a third party, we have 10 more names to consider. We may be inclined to reject the Provost Marshal, whom Thalias had persuaded to conduct the orbital cordon, but that still leaves 9. Too many. We can hardly knock on their doors to ask.
Nor can we go to Mars, said Rivas, flatly. Not in secret.
True enough, said Kral. So, we have the Speaker, the Provost Marshal, and not much else. That is where we start, though we must pursue this without leaving a trace. The moment our involvement is revealed is the moment we lose the power to investigate.
Then you already have a procedure in mind, said Spinoza.
At present, Spinoza, that is all I have, said Kral. We must access the archives in the Halls of Judgment. We need to establish what the Arbites know, or knew, and whether they are still pursuing an investigation. Even if they are not, there may be material there that can aid us. In addition, we must check for the remnants of Rasselot's forces. It seems likely to me that Dloch, her oversized henchman, never left the palace, but we must be sure. His network stretched into Salvator. We must find out if he lives, and whether he is capable of directing harm towards us. Spinoza still sat stiffly, her hands clasped before her on the tabletop.
And the speaker? She asked carefully.
She shall be my quarry, said Kral. I see no way of discovering what we need without getting close to the centre of her web. We need a name, just one, plus knowledge of what was intended.
And when all this is done, said Spinoza, and we gather a case, what then? Are we to set ourselves against the council?
A part of it.
I see.
Kral sighed. The pain suppressors didn't seem to be working. The dull ache that accompanied his every move was morphing into something sharper.
What would you have us do, Spinoza? Turn away?
No. No, of course not. She looked pained.
But there is the Lex.
Rivas smiled privately to himself.
Yes, there is the Lex, said Kral patiently. But at present there is no one we could go to, not with these rumours and half-heard whispers. We would be laughed out of the council, even supposing we were somehow granted an audience, which is doubtful.
He placed his fingertips to his temples and began to massage the flesh slowly.
We discover the truth. We can discuss what is to be done with it. But the first step, as always, is to discover the truth.
Slowly, grudgingly, Spinoza bowed. Gorgias rose up over the centre of the table, swinging wildly.
Tempus, short supply,
the skull crowed, turning to face each one of them in turn.
Now, hurry, hurry.
Quite, said Kral, wearily.
So, unless there are additional points, I see no further purpose in discussion here.
Rivas looked at Spinoza. Spinoza looked at Rivas. Neither spoke.
Very good, said Kral. Then we take up the hunt again.
He rose.
A new beginning. May the Emperor be with us all.
After that, he sent them away, all of them, even Gorgias, who clattered back to wherever Gorgias went when dismissed, grumbling bitterly all the way. Kral climbed the narrow staircase leading up from the council chamber, limping more than usual. He was already at the limit of the narcotics he could ingest, but landed a sliver of something mildly sedative to take the edge off. Was it getting worse? It was, likely. He had known for a long time that there was no ultimate escape from this slow decline. The only question was how long it would take. The poisons lodged in his bones and his organs were too deep-seated to expunge without killing him, and now Arunian's palliative cocktails were the only thing holding him together, like rusty bars clamped around a sagging wall. But there was more to it than simple bodily decline. He had breathed the same air as that thing just for a few moments. Recalling the foulness of its breath still made him want to gag. This was a world full of decay, and yet nothing, nothing could compare with the rank debauchery that had been present in those few coughed-up breaths. Everything about that monster had been uniquely despicable, a nauseating mixture of cruelty, horror, and sheer otherness that went far beyond that possessed by any human heretic or sadist. He had looked into its eyes, down in those deep pits. They had been blacker than the void itself, twin points of nothingness that sucked all life and hope out of the air. Across his many decades of service, he had never witnessed anything so completely, irredeemably corrupted. Still, he should have been able to shake the memory off. He had seen many bad things and absorbed them all. An inquisitor was expected to be able to cope, to process such poison and transmute it into something useful. A lifetime of labour, of constant training, of psycho-conditioning and ritual observance should have given him the tools to rise above anything. He reached his private rooms. His fingers danced twice, and the lumens reduced to a cold blue glow. From somewhere, a vox emitter began to play music. As so often, it was Bach. Kral's old master, Levi Palv, had been fond of saying that Bach was the only true, incontrovertible proof that humanity was worthy of continued survival, and in the years since, his pupil had come to agree with him on that, if on little else. So he sat, heavily, in a real leather armchair, and reached for the ever-present lead crystal decanter. It might have been the Xenos. Proximity to such debased specimens was prescribed for a reason. Or perhaps it was the things Navradaran had shown him before that fateful meeting. Down there, in the hallowed halls leading to the Eternity Gate itself, Kral had felt the colossal tug of the one immortal presence that guided them all. He had not slept since, not truly. Irunian's concoctions could knock him out for a while, but only far enough to provoke dreams of black gums under white lips, laughing in the shadows. What was he seeing there? The Xenos wretch? Or something closer to home, buried hard and fast and deep under that continent-sized palace? Spinoza had already noticed. He had seen similar signs with her, though not as acute. In addition, she was younger, stronger, more apt to bounce back. He found himself envying her. The iron certainties were still intact in Spinoza, so much so that it was hard to know how best to tutor her further. Inquisitors of her ilk generally had two courses ahead of them, to double down on their Puritanism and become fanatics for the throne, or have it steadily worn away until they became like he was. From the outset, for ignoble reasons, he had sought to turn Spinoza away from her inclinations and show her the folly of cleaving too close to the literal core of Ministorum doctrine. Now, he had no idea where to lead her, or even if he were capable of leading her anywhere at all. It was almost certainly too late now. Preoccupied with survival, with seeing this thing through to the end, there would be little space left for instructing his interrogator as she ought to be instructed. Still, she was no one's fool. As new to Terra's labyrinthine politics as she was, she understood that maintaining an investigation into this scheme was taking them into treacherous territory. In principle, an inquisitor was beholden to no one but the Emperor himself, able to take his or her inquiries where the evidence led, without fear of hindrance or obstruction. In practice, some members of the Order were more powerful than others, and even the very greatest would hesitate before following a thread into the Senatorum Imperialis itself. It was not fear, though, that made her hesitate. It was that she still had faith in the institutions, resisting the notion that such exalted servants could possibly behave less than perfectly. That was what stayed her hand, the belief, cultivated and maintained through her diligent recitals of the catechisms, that the High Lords could do no wrong. Kral smiled briefly in the dark, a flicker across his scarred face. Perhaps once he too would have thought the same. "Summarize," he said. A translucent hololith spiraled into life ahead of him, hanging in the gloom in a gauze of flickering green. Runes scrolled across it, followed by rasta-barred images.
"Speaker of the Chartist Captains, Kania Teled Danda," came a disembodied voice, a vox recording linked to the cogitator's spool record. "Female. Estimated age, 97 standard years. Terror born. Held speakership for 41 years. Held seat on the High Council for 31 years. Known inquisitorial investigations, none. Known suspect tendencies, none. Political affiliations, list follows." "Halt," Kral ordered, thinking. He studied the gently rotating three-dimensional image of Danda's head. She looked incredibly young, even for one with access to the very best rejuve treatments. Her hair was pulled back into a tight bun, and she carried two small tattoos on her right cheek, charter marks, no doubt, from her ascent through the hierarchy. Her expression on the hololith was blank, with her tight mouth held firm and flat. She looked unaugmented, unlike the grotesquely altered Fabricator General. Normal, almost. And yet, no High Lord was normal. They held truly massive amounts of power in their hands, accumulated collectively over thousands of years. Each one was an emperor in their own right, a potentate capable of drawing on near untrammelled volumes of patronage and resource. Some were flashier than others. The Grand Master of Assassins, say, or his own ultimate mistress, the Inquisitorial Representative, they tended to attract the most fear. Danda, though, was as quietly influential as any of them. It had been estimated that 9 out of 10 ships in the Imperium fell under her purview. If the merchant fleet stopped plying their trade across the yawning void, then the Imperium would swiftly fall apart. Whether it was hauling ores from mining asteroids to forge worlds, or munitions from those forges to the Militarum regiments, or foodstuffs from agri-worlds to the teeming hive spires, the merchant charters were the mortar that held the tottering structures of the Imperium together. A word from Danda, and billions could prosper or decline, live in ease or starve. Kral had often wondered what such power did to a person. The High Lords were not genetically enhanced constructs like Navradaran, as limited by design as they were powerful. They were men and women like him, capable of doubt, capable of weakness. Even, as seemed possible now, capable of treachery. He took a long swig, emptying his glass, and the hololith flickered out. It had been a long time since sleep had been restful. He had doubts that this night would be any different. There was so much he didn't understand, and so little time to discover the necessary truths. "Anila," he said out loud into the darkness, activating his comline.
"Lord,"
came the crackling reply, crisp and ready. Anila was so perfectly reliable.
"I require a meeting with a colleague," Kral said. "Slek Nor Jarod. His details are in Hook's records. Speak to his people. Impress upon them the need for haste."
"By your will."
"Secure channels."
"Of course."
Then the link cut out, the hololith span away, and Kral was alone again, in the dark, thinking hard.